Welcome to the All IVF Ever Wanted podcast with
Gareth
and
Emma.
That's me. Documenting our next and possibly final round of IVF. This process will be keeping me sane and probably driving Gareth
a little bit crazy.
So we hope that this does also help you guys as well. So enjoy the episode. This episode, I've got Emma Whitney with me, and Emma Whitney is the lab manager at the Evewell Clinic in London. Now, as you would have heard on a previous episode, that is where we're going for our next round of IVF. So Emma Whitney has suddenly become like this deep breath, super important person. She's super important anyway. But Emma, could you please introduce yourself? Tell us a bit about you. Tell us a bit about how you've ended up at Evewell and your journey before that in this field.
Sure. So thank you for having me. So my name's Emma. I've been an embryologist about 18 years. I started my embryology journey after several years at university, ending with a master's degree in human reproductive medicine. I joined St. Bartholomew's Hospital where I did my training. I then spent 13 years at the Lister Fertility Clinic, which is a very big clinic in London. And ultimately my career there escalated to me being the genetics lead embryologist as my career became very, very focused in genetics and genetic testing of embryos. I then was decided that it was time for a move, and I moved over to the Evewell several months ago, where I am now the lab manager with a very specialist interest in genetic testing of embryos. And here we are.
So basically, this lady knows a lot of things that are going to be very useful to a lot of people that are listening to this podcast, because as I was just explaining to Emma off camera, I know that a lot of you guys that are listening are embarking on IVF after loss and embarking on IVF perhaps after termination for medical reasons. And what comes with that sometimes is discovering that, sadly, as parents, we are both carriers for something that we pass on to our children, or that we have a balanced translocation perhaps, and that is coming through when we are creating our babies. So we then go on to get into the world of IVF, if that is the case, if it's a genetic reason. And this is where someone like Emma is really important in our journey, because there's a lot that has to happen, right? So I'd love to go into the different types of testing, because people that have never done IVF before and are super new to this get really confused by what's PGT, what's PGD, what's PGS, what's all this stuff, you know, and what does it mean? And what are the parameters of those tests? And I'd love to kind of unpack a bit of that with you.
Cool. How long you got? okay. So I'm going to start, probably the best thing to start with is the terminology. I think it really confuses everyone. Embryology is not very easy in the fact that we keep changing our wording. I think the world has now come into line of what we're going to call all of this. And so I'm going to give everyone sort of a recap here of how this is termed and what equals what exactly. So PGS is the old school name for pre-implantation genetic screening. That is now termed as PGTA, which is pre-implantation genetic testing of aneuploidies. Now, an aneuploidy is when something is chromosomally abnormal. So in your case, Emma, mm-hmm. with the trisomy 18, that is three copies of chromosome 18 leading to Edwards syndrome, which is termed an aneuploidy. Mm-hmm. Anything that involves chromosomes is termed aneuploidy. When we talk about PGD, that is what used to be called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, we are looking for specifics. We are looking for things that are inherited. Mm-hmm. And there's two types now. There's two sort of umbrellas that this covers. We've got PGTSR, which stands for pre-implantation genetic testing for structural rearrangements. So just like you said, someone that carries a balanced translocation, also inversions, they might know about this from having miscarriages or unfortunately pregnancy loss. And the other umbrella part of that is called PGTM, which is pre-implantation genetic testing for monogenic disorders. Now, a monogenic disorder is a gene, it's inherited, It can be either that you both carry it and therefore it's called a recessive condition, where you have to have mum and dad carry it to have a chance of having an affected child, or you can have a dominant condition where you or your partner carry it, and therefore your child can have that condition. So we would be looking for a specific gene. Mm-hmm. So those are the three, the way it's termed now. I think just for clarity, most clinics use PGTA as PGS and everything else falls under PGD. But like I said, they are very much termed into the three categories now. Mm-hmm. The testing is all achieved quite differently. So it's really important that when you do have any testing, we're getting the right test, because one size doesn't fit all. The testing that we use, the technology we use, is massively different between the three entities.
Mm-hmm. It is really a complete minefield. And to somebody that doesn't have the expertise that you have, it's completely overwhelming and can be very overwhelming. And I hear a lot of people say that they're going to get PGT and that's all they need, because that will, you know, but it's not. I know that's not, because it can only test for so many conditions. Is that right?
Yeah. So PGTA. So let's go with an analogy, because mm-hmm. I think this one helps people. I love a visualization. I think if you can visualize something, you can maybe, it's really hard if you're not a scientist to try and visualize genetics and embryos. So I like to use my library as my visualization. So imagine you walk into a library, and in this library, there are 46 bookshelves. Okay, on the right there are 23, and on the left there are 23. The bookshelves in this library represent your chromosomes. Okay, mm-hmm. So every cell in your body has got 46 chromosomes. 23 come from your mum and 23 come from your dad. When we are creating embryos, the egg and the sperm come together and they each hold 23 chromosomes. So these are our bookshelves in our library. And this is what each parent is bringing to the table when they're creating an embryo. And the embryo ultimately end up with 46 bookshelves in a normal scenario. So we're going to say our bookshelves are our chromosomes. Now, on every chromosome, there will be a different number of books. And that is correlating to your genes. So on chromosome one, for example, it's a massive bookshelf. It's got a lot of books. It's got a lot of genes. As we go down to chromosome 22, it's quite a small bookshelf. It's got not so many genes. They're all very important, but that's what happens in the chromosomes. They've all got different amount of genetic information on them. Now, so you've got your bookshelves and you've got your books, and inside your books are the words, and the words are your genetic code. So when we talk about PGTA, we are looking for losses and gains of bookshelves. We are looking to see if the library doesn't fit properly. So if there's too many bookshelves, there's too much information. If there's not enough bookshelves, there's not enough information. And when we talk about PGTSR, the bookshelves are in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't all fit together again in the space that they're allowed to be in.
And that would be the balanced translocations.
And that would be the balanced translocations. And when mm-hmm. you talk about PGTM, you're actually trying to find an error on a page in a book. It is that small. So you need to firstly know where you're looking. A question I get asked quite a lot is, well, why can't I just test for everything? Mm-hmm. But if I don't know what I'm looking for, mm-hmm. then you're asking me to go through an entire library with 23 bookshelves, mm-hmm. with 6,000 books, and who knows, 1 billion base pair letters. That it is something like it is beyond a needle in a haystack. So for PGTM, you have to know where you're looking, which is why we need to know where the variants are, in which book, in which gene, and who's mm-hmm. carrying them and how it's being carried, etc. So that, I think if you can visualize that, that can help us talk about mm-hmm. PGT as a mm-hmm. whole. Mm-hmm. And that helps us, that's kind of what I use. It helps people see it a bit better.
And when we get into the realms of looking for a page, a word within a page, within a book, within a bookshelf, within the library, but when we're in that space, that's when, and my understanding is that that's when we're looking at parents and we're saying, right, what's going on with you as parents, and doing yeah. these tests on the parents to try yeah. and find out what we may need to then go and look for within the embryo. Is that right?
Absolutely. So we're looking at which code in which book is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately when the embryos come round, we can test those embryos to see which pages have been inherited, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
So rather than looking for millions, we're saying, yeah. I know the parents,
I know what I'm looking for,
are carrying this, or one parent has this and that's an inherited something on a page. So now I'm going to go and look for that one thing because I know what I'm looking for.
Yeah, so you can hone in and you can identify where it is, what you're looking for, and then you can start to talk about embryos being affected and unaffected with genetic disease because we can identify which page has been inherited into their library. So And that's why it's not possible just to look at 6,000 genes. You have to say, right, there's a problem with this gene, there's a problem with that gene. They match in both of you, so you've got a 1 in 4 chance of having an affected child. So we would make a group of embryos and do a biopsy in exactly the same way we would for any PGT testing, but we'd be honing in on the genetic code to see exactly, you know, if the bad bits have been inherited and not the good bits, and then we can identify which embryos to use.
And then I want to talk to you about the biopsy part, because people ask about this all the time. So, and they get super, like, I got really confused at the beginning and I still don't have half an idea. I have a quarter of an idea perhaps about what might go on. But people, it sort of blows people's brains that something so small can have something taken from it when it's at such a minute size. You know, we're talking teeny tiny.
Clever, isn't it?
Very clever.
Okay, so probably the best way for me to describe this is if I start off on a bit of a very, very basic embryo course of how embryos develop. So an embryo starts as a single cell, as an egg. It meets a sperm and it fertilizes, and that is a single egg. That's day one. Day two, embryos grow between 2 and 4 cells. Day three, they're between 5 and 8, 5 and 10. Day four, they're actually called morulas when they start to compact down. And I like to think about them as discussing who's going to become which bits. And they're between 32 and 64 cells at that point. And then by the time we get to day five and day six, where you're dealing with what's called the elusive blastocyst stage, you are dealing with an entity that is between 100 and 200 cells. They are spherical and they have 2 cell lines. So you have an inner cell line that makes the fetus, and you have an outer cell line that is called the trophectoderm that makes the placental cells. Now, we don't want to touch the inner cell mass because that's the bit that makes the baby, but we can associate the outer cells with the inner cells and test those outer cells. Now, on that outer cell layer, there is sometimes in excess of 120 cells. I want to take 5. And I know that sounds absolutely bonkers, but we are dealing with some of the best micromanipulation equipment that the world has to offer. And they are microscopes. And when I learned to train in biopsy, someone said to me, go away and play the PlayStation. And I said, don't be so ridiculous. And they said, but it is, because it's actually all about hand-eye coordination. So what we're dealing with is an embryo on a microscope with these very, very fine tools that are, you actually can't see the end of one of them because it's so thin. And you have to like put them on, and then everything's microscoped, and you've got these paddles that you move around exactly like a PlayStation. It's amazing. And then we use a very small laser. And what we would do is very gently aspirate being a clever word for suck, some cells up the biopsy pipette. And we use the laser to remove them. We've got such control, and I wouldn't even go into the how long it takes to train to do this. But you are dealing with something that's massively robust. It's embryos, I think people see them as this fragility. They're incredible. They are not fragile. They can tolerate so much. And we're asking it to give us 5 of its outer cell lines. They don't mind. They're absolutely fine. And we take those cells, we actually tube those cells into a tiny little tube that goes off to the genetics lab. And then the embryo is immediately frozen and stays in the clinic. Biopsy is actually my favorite thing to do. It is, it's amazing to watch them behave, but they are, I think if anything can take away from this podcast with you, Emma, is that embryos are incredibly robust. They're really good. They go through a lot. Once you put them back, they've got to implant into a lining, and they've got to work against your immune system and all sorts of things. They are just very strong, so they can tolerate it.
I know you said we won't talk about how long it takes to train, but how long does it take to train to do this?
So embryology is a funny one, because you can't get into embryology until you've been at uni for like 5 years. And then when you start embryology, you start eggs and sperm, because egg collections and sperm is the first thing that we start with. it's not, I'm never going to say it's easy, but it is the easiest part of our job. And then as you go through the processes, you learn more about embryos. So you start looking at embryo culture and embryo transfers and embryo freezing and thawing. And it's not until you've mastered all of that that you get to go on what's called the ICSI rig, which is where we do the ICSI. And that's the micro manipulation tool that we also do the biopsy on. So what comes next is ICSI. And then you probably have to fine tune that technique over, you know, a year or so, because you are, for a lot of the time, you're doing half cases, because we don't, we're protecting the embryologist as much as we're protecting the patient by making sure that everyone's supervised and everything's covered. And it's probably not until about 6 years in that you then start to have the technical skill to start talking about blastocyst biopsy. And even then, we would like you to biopsy. I mean, I train people quite regularly, and depending on skill set, I would ask someone to biopsy a minimum of 25 embryos. And be validated. And when I talk about validation, I talk about removing those cells and getting a genetic result from them to know that the job they're doing is going to result in a test result. And I suppose that can take anything between another 3 and 6 months. So, you know, you're 6-7 years in, and then you've got that on top. And even then, we end up doing half cases. Embryology is extremely supervised. It's extremely tight. We don't just let people loose on things, because that would be really irresponsible.
And when you say, so you do, like, how do you practice? Like, how do you practice on an embryo?
Fantastic question. And I think it's a really important one to talk about, because we cannot practice on anything without consent.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you do your HFEA and HFEA consents in the UK, I'm not sure what they're like in the UAE, but there will be a consent form. And that consent is about, what are you allowing us to do in the event that there are any spares? Now, when we talk about training and research in these consent forms, they are never to do with anything that we call active in your use. So they're not going to be eggs you can use, sperm you can use, embryos you can use. But if you've come to the end of your journey for whatever reason, and maybe you've had your family, or maybe you've decided not to have a family, and you have embryos in the freezer that you are going to remove from storage, there is a consent form there that says, can we use them in training? So we rely on people understanding that without that consent, we can't train anyone. And I think once you explain that to people, that the reason we're able to do IVF, the reason I can do IVF, is because people have given me embryos and eggs to train on throughout my career that has allowed me to progress. So without that, we're stuck. So, and that actually is a real time determining step in training someone, especially in a smaller clinic, because you are relying on not as many embryos becoming available. And it can really put the stoppers on people's training. So I think it's a really important thing to highlight, that when we ask you to consent to training, it's not for what we're using in your treatment. It's for what you're not using or is left over and can't be used, if that makes sense.
And would you use, I don't know, would it just be the ones that you, that people have chosen not to use, or would it be ones that have come back genetically abnormal that you then practice with? Or
again, if we had training consents, yes.
Yeah.
But only with consent. Yeah. I won't do anything without patient consent.
No. But it's just interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, how do we make these advances? How do we get to have people like you that are incredibly skilled at what you do to give someone like me, for example, a chance of having a family, right? Like, and it is like this sort of roundabout type of relationship, I suppose, between patient and, you know, professional.
Absolutely.
To make this happen.
I think a lot of the reason I want to do, you know, talk to people like you, Emma, is because ultimately I think there's this massive lack of information, and I think there's this fear of the unknown, and there's this fear of what goes on behind that door, behind that hatch in that embryology lab. And if we can make that a little bit more accessible and make people understand what it is we're actually asking for, I think people would be far more willing, because the fear, the fear gets removed with knowledge. So it's important that we talk about all these things that some people are like, well, that's not important. Well, it is, because we, like you said, I would never have been at the stage I'm at now had I have not had embryos to work on, because I would never have been able to train.
No. And it's interesting that you say that, because we've done all of our treatment in the UAE, we haven't done 7 rounds of IVF, but we've done 7 rounds of fertility treatment, 2 rounds of IVF, and we're now coming to you. And but that was after having 4 consultations with UK-based clinics, and the only clinic at the first point of call that let us have direct access and conversation with an embryologist was Evewell.
Yeah.
And I cannot tell you how much that meant as a patient.
But I think, again, it comes back to, we shouldn't be hidden, because all it just creates is this level of, it's not illusion, it's fear. I mean, who are these people? They're literally going to be taking my gametes off me and creating these embryos. I mean, we're human beings, and I want a lot of the reason actually that I went to the Evewell is because I want to be with you through your journey, not behind a door.
And patients, I think, really appreciate that, because it is a bit like you have so much contact with your doctor, and you know, it's all the rev up, right, to the egg collection, which is exhausting, right? Because you're just as a woman, like a hormonal mess, you're losing your head by the time egg collection day comes. And then you do it, and then it's like, it's such a, I don't know, like a rev up, right? And then it's like eggs collected, and you kind of just fall off the edge. And you're just like free falling, waiting for a call, waiting, and you don't know what goes on. And like you say, it's like behind those doors, something happens, and we just hope, in 6 days' time, something's going to pop out the other side.
Through the hatch, just, waving.
Yeah, like, please send something back through the hatch, you know, like.
I know.
And
I
it is a bit like that. And I think, you know.
Yeah, there is an element that there's an element that, especially where at the Evewell, we want you to know us, we want you to be very aware of what we're doing, but ultimately those 5 or 6 days, there's a management of expectations there. So we will talk to you on day one when we've got fertilization, but anything we tell you between day one and day five can be misconstrued, can be inaccurate, can be not very valuable when we're trying to talk about managing mental health and managing people's expectations. So I like to give people the options. Do you really want to talk to us on day three when I could give you good news and it could still be not very good news? Or do you want to just, let's get to the end point where we know we've got to be, and let's have a really full discussion once I've got all the information at hand. And a lot of people, once you put it like that, say, actually, I don't want to be on this roller coaster this week. I'm just going to, you know, shut off and I'll speak to you on day five. And, you know, like, you know, we bring everyone in and we'll talk to them face to face. So again, it's personal choice. But again, I think if you can start the process by telling, and everyone should be free to ask, how do your processes work? You know, what do you do? Talk to me about it. Let me visualize it. Let me, everyone's going to be a bit more comfortable if they've met us to leave us to it for 5 days to do what we're good at doing, I suppose.
And that's it. It's not necessarily about the phone calls, because the phone calls don't really reduce the anxiety. But for us, the thing that reduced our anxiety and helped our choice was having that conversation where someone really explained what goes on in those 6 days, you know, because we're just people, right? We haven't trained in this stuff. To us, it's like this sort of black hole of 6 days. What goes on in there? You know, we don't know. So it's, it definitely does help with reducing anxiety and helps with building that trust of not necessarily needing that, because we know that it's being looked after and this is the process. And if you understand it a bit more, like you say, the fear is reduced.
Absolutely. Yeah, very much so. And I think that's why this is a really important thing to be doing, is because anything that can help people go, oh, okay, we're okay, everything, you know, everything's going well in there, and they've met the people involved, and they absolutely should. I urge everyone to ask to meet their embryologist.
And I think definitely on the first time round, you definitely underestimate that part. You don't even, honestly, you don't even think about that part. You just think about what you've got to inject yourself with, getting to egg retrieval.
Well, yeah, of course.
And you just don't think past that. And then you get to that bit and you're like, oh, I have no idea what happens there.
Yeah. Yeah. And that I think is where people's mental health can really fall off a cliff, because it's just this level of fear that nobody was expecting.
Just unknown. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's go back to the genetic testing just briefly. So we do a biopsy.
Yep.
And depending on the presentation of perhaps past pregnancies or past losses or what we know about family history genetically, we've chosen which of these three we're going to do, because mm-hmm. we need to do them for whatever reason. So then what? Where does it go? Who does what with it?
Question.
How long does it take?
So with PGTA, which is the one we do most commonly, which is the bookshelves and the aneuploidies, so that we're looking at the chromosomes. So this is one that we use in advanced maternal age. We mm-hmm. use it for people like yourselves with previous mm-hmm. aneuploid conceptions, or people with recurrent miscarriage, or even in people with recurrent implantation failure of unknown reason. Mm-hmm. PGTA is not 100% supported under 35. I think there's a bit of a grey area between 35 and 37. I personally feel that it's an absolute, almost must over 37 if you've got embryos developing to the blastocyst stage, and you will absolutely reduce your time to pregnancy if you utilise this technology. PGTA, to say hands up, does not change your embryos. It does not make them better. But if you've got five and only one of them is going to be good, then let's never use those other four. Let's not put you through four frozen cycles that you don't need to go through mm-hmm. until we get to that one. Because mm-hmm. let's face it, that's going to break people as well. And I've seen people stop because it's just all too much. Mm-hmm. So PGTA is a tool to help us get you there quicker mm-hmm. and to make sure that if there is no embryos available in that cycle, you can move on without wasting a year putting frozen embryos back. So mm-hmm. firstly, that's where I think PGTA sits. In a really positive way. So what happens is we don't need to design anything. In this thing, it is a one size fits all. We are looking for chromosomes. We know exactly what they look like. And there is a test called next generation sequencing that allows us to see the numbers or the copies of chromosomes in the cells that we've biopsied. Mm-hmm. So those cells go off to a genetics lab. There's several in the UK. There's several probably where you are as well in the UAE, and they will be molecular genetic biologists that are using technology, like I said, called NGS. Mm-hmm. And those cells will be processed, and then they give us a result of copy number. And if it's a 46XY or XX, in the UK, we never find out if it's XX or XY because that's the gender of the embryo.
Yeah.
It will just come back and say normal mm-hmm. or euploid. So we use the term euploid. If the embryo is abnormal, mm-hmm. it will tell us where it's abnormal. So in your situation with the baby you lost, it would mm-hmm. have come back as trisomy 18. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it comes back with things that don't have a term, such as I've seen a trisomy 1. That hasn't got a name because it's completely incompatible with life. Mm-hmm. It most likely wouldn't make you pregnant, but they mm-hmm. do happen. We mm-hmm. only talk so much about trisomy 21, 18 and 13 because they're very compatible with ongoing pregnancy and we mm-hmm. see more of them. I don't think the others don't happen as often. Mm-hmm. I think that we don't have a name. And I think a lot of the time embryos that don't develop to the blastocyst stage do have something wrong with them, mm-hmm. but they never get to a point where we're testing them. So it's not that, so it's not like trisomy 2 doesn't happen, mm-hmm. but it's probably such a profound problem that the mm-hmm. embryo can't actually grow in the first place. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've seen a trisomy 2. There's lots of ones that I think, have I seen that? And it's like, mm-hmm. but it's probably where I say to you, right, you've got your 10 embryos and I've got four blastocysts. Well, what happened to the other six? They are probably the ones that we don't see on the testing platform. Like I said, not because they're not happening, but because they're just not compatible with embryo development. Mm-hmm. So the cells go off to the lab and they come back with these results. And then we have a look through those results and we will speak to you about, you know, what exactly those results are. Mm-hmm. There's normal euploid, there's mm-hmm. abnormal aneuploid, and then there's mosaic.
Yes.
Which is a really tricky one. So mosaic is where there's good and bad cells. And this is evolving really quickly at the moment. There's a lot of evidence coming out to support the use of mosaic embryos. And there is now extra layers of testing called parental origin testing, which I haven't got 6 hours to go into, so I won't. But to be very aware that mosaic testing is a mosaic availability of mosaic embryo use is becoming increasingly, and I use the word exciting because I think it is exciting. I think it's going to give women more access to more embryos, and ultimately that can only be a good thing. Mm-hmm. So those are the three results we get when we get the embryos, the page back.
And is that because the mosaic embryos can correct themselves and turn into, or is it because they was just two abnormal cells in 200 cells?
So where did the abnormality come from?
Yes.
Okay, so if the abnormalities come from the egg or the sperm, then it's probably in most of the cells, and the good cells are probably outliers, not inliers. Mm-hmm. If we can identify the abnormality we're seeing didn't come from the gametes, the eggs and the sperm, then probably most of the cells are good, and the good cells are the majority, and the bad cells are the you know, the outliers, so to speak, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. And therefore, we do think that the bad cells, I don't think self-correction is ultimately the right terminology. I think what happens is the good cells almost take over the bad cells, and the bad mm-hmm. cells just die off.
Okay.
So yes, you could term it self-correction, but ultimately the embryo has got full control, and the embryo is actually a normal embryo.
So the cells themselves aren't like changing. It's just that they get outgrown by more good cells than bad, and it grows into being overwhelmingly good.
And the good cells send off signals, and those mm-hmm. cells die off because of that. There's a lot of communication that goes on in an embryo. It's an extremely clever thing. So I think the take home point here is mosaic embryos do not, if you get a mosaic embryo, we are in a really good position at the moment to talk about what to do with those.
Mm-hmm. And does it depend what the mosaic is as yes. to it? Yeah. So
yes and no. So yes, if you can add the extra layer of testing, if you're in a clinic that can add extra layer of testing, which again is very new, so I'm not expecting that to be readily available at the moment. I think it's coming. Mm-hmm. At the EVE, well, we have got that extra layer of testing, so we're really lucky at the moment that we can do all of this. In other clinics where you have mosaic embryos, there's always going to be a genetic counsellor involved who can talk to you about what that means if that mosaicism is true on that chromosome. Mm-hmm. And then you can make informed decisions about what you do with those embryos.
Mm-hmm. It's a minefield, isn't it? And it's so interesting, and what you do is so clever. And Emma, I just want to say, like, this is just sound only, guys, but if you could see Emma's face, I've never seen someone who is so absolutely thrilled and excited about embryos. Like, this woman is so enthusiastic about embryos. I'm here for this.
I mean, This is what, you know, you make people's dreams come true. You don't get to do that every day. It's brilliant.
That is very true. And, you know, the other thing that I just picked up on that you said is that we don't get to know if the sex of the embryo, if it's male or female. Yeah. And I wondered that, because obviously when it goes off to be to this genetic lab, they would know that, because it comes through. It has to, right?
Yeah, it does.
So is it that they put it on the report and you at the clinic don't tell, or is it that it doesn't go on the report?
I'm not legally allowed to know.
Okay.
So because I could have friends having IVF, I could have someone that I know wants a girl, you know, I could be completely swayed, and therefore my clinical practices would be in problematic judgment. Mm-hmm. So they have to check the sex chromosomes, because you can have aneuploidies on the sex chromosomes. For example, there's a condition called Klinefelter's syndrome, mm-hmm. which is XXY. So they are doing a copy count on the sex chromosomes. They're just as important as the bookshelves. They're all important. Mm-hmm. But they don't report on gender. The only time mm-hmm. I get a gender report is if I've got a medical reason. So, for example, if someone carries haemophilia is a sex-linked disorder where it will pass to boys and it will be carried by girls. Mm-hmm. So we can do sex selection in a medical reason. But otherwise, for PGTA, I'm legally not allowed to know. And they're not allowed to tell me either. And they could, like, everyone's license can get in a lot of trouble if we start talking about gender.
So if, and this is just a question, this is a region, this is a jurisdiction thing for me, because obviously I've only ever had treatment in Dubai, right? Mm. So this information is given.
Yeah.
You can ask not to be told, but it's just comes on the report and they just email it to you. Yeah. Quite often they'll email it to you without your permission, and it happens. But basically, because it's just standard practice, it's just here's the information and off it goes. So it's a bit sort of mad like that. But for example, Turner syndrome is girls only, right?
Well, it's X naught, so it's 45 X naught. So it's actually termed an aneuploid embryo that is missing a sex chromosome. They are female because the Y chromosome determines male. And if there is no Y chromosome, I think this is something probably most people don't know, that the default of an embryo is to develop into a female, unless there's a Y chromosome that provides a switch. Mm-hmm. So with X naught, yes, they have female, and that they are phenotypically what we saw present as females, but they normally are infertile. They sometimes are born without ovaries. They're sometimes born without uteruses. Yes, but they are specifically, they would be female if they were born.
Mm. So if say I had a load of embryos, did PGTA, for example, and one came back as abnormal, and it was Turner syndrome, would I just know that it was Turner syndrome, and then I just by default know that it would have been a female embryo?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. It's a difficult one to answer. So I would know, because it's abnormal in those senses, you are allowed to term gender, because in the UK, we're not, you can use abnormal embryos, but not in the preference of a normal. And I am told if it's a Klinefelter's embryo, because when they tell us what the abnormality is, if it's a sex chromosome abnormality, I would know. Yes, I do get that on the report, because it's an aneuploid embryo. Yes. And I suppose the default from the genetics lab is they have to report what the abnormality is.
Yeah.
So if the abnormality is a sex chromosome abnormality, then yes, that is the only time I'm told.
Yeah, and that would be the only time the parents would know, because just by default of the condition, it defines the sex. So interesting.
And what's really interesting is if you have testing somewhere where you are, Emma, you cannot, and those embryos are diagnosed for sex, you can't then utilise those embryos in the UK, because you can't transfer them into the UK, because it breaks the code of practice that we work under. And that becomes a really frustrating thing for people having treatment in the States and then trying to come to London with their embryos, because we literally are legally not allowed to take them in.
Oh, so in the States, the sex safety,
Gender,
it's the same as here,
Very much.
Interesting, isn't it? Thank you for telling me that. I just find these little pieces within it just fascinating, you know, because it's just, there's so many little avenues it can go down, right, isn't there? So is there anything else that you'd like to cover off genetics wise before I ask you the last question?
I don't think so. I think the only thing to say about the other two that we were talking about, PGTSR obviously is a family thing that you would know about. Now, PGTSR is done with NGS, but what we call high resolution NGS, so it is a copy count number. I think to say with PGTM is for people to be aware that there is quite a lot of pre-workup process that goes into PGTM testing. It's not quite as simple as turning up at a clinic saying, I know I've got a genetic condition, therefore can I test my embryos? There is a lot of what we call the pre-workup stage, because just because one couple carry, for example, cystic fibrosis, it is completely different to another couple carrying cystic fibrosis. I'll go back to my books. The mutation that they carry might be on different pages. So we would still need to hone in. We would still need to do a workup. So I think it's important that if you are embarking upon PGTM treatment of any description, you should be preparing yourself for between a 2 and 6 month wait before you're allowed to start treatment, because there is a process that needs to happen first so that we've got the right technology to test the embryos against. That's probably an important one to mention.
And when you say the workup, do you mean the tests on the parents?
Yeah, so you would take blood from the parents, you would take, or DNA, you can do it most of the time now on cheek swabs. And if there are any affected children or any affected relatives, that really helps with us mapping the puzzle. The more DNA we can get from close relatives, the more we can map where we're looking for in the book. You know, it just helps us hone in. They're called reference markers. So there are sometimes some really difficult questions I've had to, on a number of occasions, if someone's had a termination for medical reasons, for example, because of an affected pregnancy, there will be DNA from that baby, and that can be used in the workup to make the test more accurate for their treatment. And that can be a really hard one to have that conversation, but it's really important to understand that it's in the interest of trying to get you the most accurate test. So there sometimes there's some things that probably catch people off guard that we're going to ask about, and obviously they should be asked sensitively. But yeah, so it's stuff like that we would ask for. We're always looking for directly related DNA that can help us create a test to make your outcome the most accurate it can be.
And it's very difficult when you're in that place, you know, and you get asked that question, because it comes very quickly. You suddenly find yourself in a place where you can't continue with your pregnancy, or I say decide, choose. It doesn't really feel like that. No, but it doesn't really feel like that. You get given a load of choices you don't really want to make, but you have to make one. And you choose the one that feels the least worst, in the words of ARC, the one that feels the least worst to you. And you then make this decision that we're no longer going to continue. And then the next thing you get asked while you're still pregnant is, are you going to have a postmortem on? And you're like, it's just a lot. And in that moment, if you've never been in this space where you've been in a loss space or an IVF space or anything, you're not thinking like you are, right? You're thinking in a really smart, long-term view way, right? How do we get the best information to help this family build a healthy family that they can bring home living babies, right? That's your goal. And it's very difficult when you're in that parent space, being told you can't carry on, can't keep your baby, and then you get hit with all these things. And it's on reflection now, I can look back and think, oh, of course that makes sense that that would be asked. It's such a difficult position for everyone involved, I think. And I think, yeah, when you're in that space, there's so much going on, and there's a part of you that thinks, no, I don't want anything else to happen to my baby. I just want my baby to be left alone.
Yeah.
And it's not until you kind of get further along and you think, oh, actually that could have been useful. Yeah. It's difficult.
It's incredibly difficult. I think there is a place for termination, especially for medical reasons, to have a genetic counsellor on standby at all times to talk through this in a very rational, because you are faced with the ultimate, and it's not a choice. It's, you know, like you said, it's something that you've got, which is the worst of the evils that you've got to deal with. But to have someone maybe on standby to have those conversations, I think is probably what's lacking in that journey. And it's just the lack of genetic counsellors that are available to give you. To say in the UK that all terminations for medical reasons, there is, even if there's no post-mortem, there is DNA kept. It's a matter of routine. So it's almost, in a way, unless you physically sign against it, it's very much something that they do. And they do that because of this scenario. So I think it's important that people are aware that it does happen. I completely appreciate that's not just the last thing you're thinking about when
it's just with this. But you know, like when, as I listen to you talk, it's completely logical, makes complete sense. I can understand where you're coming from. Your goal is thinking, right, okay, it's not disregarding the sadness that's happened, but it's not understanding and appreciating that this family is likely to want to try and continue to build their family, or maybe most, you know, quite a lot of cases, at least that one might be there immediately, it might change. And you're thinking that long-term view, which is impossible to see when you're in the middle of like a bomb. Oh,
absolutely.
Going off.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's why people like me or genetic counsellors should absolutely, you know, there should be bereavement people involved to help you make those decisions, you know, because you can't think straight at that point.
No. But it's just nice to hear it from your point of view, you know, because it does make sense. And when you're thinking, getting into the, especially the world of like IVF and genetic testing, suddenly the importance of these things becomes massive.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then the last question before we go, which might be too big a question, in which case we can come back to it another time, but let me know, was just, we touched on it at the beginning. I had quite a few people message saying, if you don't have many eggs or you have diminished ovarian reserve, what is the best way? Because a couple of people have said, do we do genetic testing? And, you know, they get unsure when there's not a lot of eggs, right?
Yeah, it's a really personal choice, and it's one that we would help you with. I mean, when we're talking about diminished ovarian reserve, that is anything under, you know, sort of certain AMH levels, and we may only end up with 3, 4, even less eggs in the laboratory. Now, genetic testing, when we talk about genetic testing for disease, is obviously, we're going to put that to one side, because there is no alternative to that apart from getting pregnant and having a CVS or an amniocentesis, which obviously is a completely separate conversation. But when we talk about genetic testing on a PGTA level in a woman with low ovarian reserve, I think the way I would approach it is based on a lot on medical history, on what I know about her potential to create embryos. An embryo cannot be changed by testing it, like I said earlier. What it can do is stop you using one that's going to give you an even more difficult route to having your family. Now, what I will say is that most aneuploid embryos do not make you pregnant. And if they do, they make you pregnant shortly and clinically. And this is me taking the emotion out of this, because no one is belittling this loss. Loss is loss. but it makes you pregnant for a very short period of time, and clinically you can move on quite quickly from a biochemical loss. Mm-hmm. It's the conceptions that end up in what you've been through, Emma, or with miscarriage at 8-9 weeks that needs some surgery, that can really delay you having another treatment cycle. And when you are dealing with diminished ovarian reserve, that's most likely either because you are going into early menopause, there is fundamentally something genetic going on, there is an advanced maternal age issue. And these are people that do not have this time. They don't have 6 months to continue to wait to see what happens. So I think there's two sides to this coin. There is a one egg, one embryo, you know, let's see if it grows to the blastocyst stage and let's just put it back. We're not going to change it either way. And I would say 50 to 60% of the time, it just won't make you pregnant. If it's not normal, no time will be lost. My frustration comes, and my advice comes from those that have more eggs, more embryos, say 2 or 3 embryos, and maybe they all grow to the blastocyst stage. I think then there's still a place for this. I think there's a place to say, we haven't got time to waste. We really haven't. So let's find out that we're going to be putting something back good. And if there is nothing good, crack on straight away to another cycle, if that's what your choices are. Yeah. Equally, the other argument is, I still can't support in a good laboratory, if your laboratory is good and they have a good culture system, putting embryos back before day 5, for me, is just prolonging the inevitable. It'll either, they won't grow to blastocyst and you'll get a negative test, or we're still in the same boat where we may be dealing with aneuploid conceptions. So I think for low ovarian reserve, I think the take home from that is probably, I think everyone's medical history is really important. And I think their particular take on what they want to do, it has to be part of it. Ultimately, I think a good quality blastocyst can tolerate biopsy, freezing, and it doesn't diminish your chance of having a baby. But by putting an embryo back that is untested, you are potentially putting yourself up to a time lengthy delay between you know, a potential miscarriage and then another start of a treatment cycle. And this is me just being practical embryology, Emma. I'm not even going into the emotional side of it, which could set you back another 6 months, understandably.
No, I mean, and it makes sense to me, because there is that thing that people say that by having your embryos tested, it increases your chance of getting pregnant. But the truth is, it doesn't change the embryo. It just means that we're not putting in embryos that don't have the best chance of carrying on, and we're not putting back in abnormal embryos that ultimately could end up in my situation, where my body clearly hung on very well to a very poorly baby for a very long time, right? Like, so I didn't miscarry, even though lots of people do miscarry, right? But some people don't. Some people, you know, my body hung on to a very poorly baby. So for me, it's, yes, I might only get, like, you know, someone with diminished ovarian reserve might only get one embryo or two embryos, but to know that the embryo going back in has the best chance is increasing your chances of a live birth, I think. But just testing it doesn't change my embryo if I test it or not, right?
But it does give you the information to make informed decisions. And the only thing I suppose I can say is that, from, if you'd asked me this 10 years ago, we'd be in a very different conversation. The the biopsy that we do now, the processes we use now, the freezing techniques we use now are so fine-tuned. That embryo survival is at 95% post-biopsy and post-freeze. Pregnancy rate is comparable, if not better, because you're only ever putting back normal embryos, and frozen embryo transfers are comparable anyway. So we are in such a better place now with IVF and IVF techniques that we can look after embryos. We can freeze even average quality embryos now and get really good survival rates. So I think the fear element again needs to be removed. And I go back to what I said earlier about them being far more robust than you realize. They really are, and they can tolerate all of this.
It's interesting, isn't it? I'm looking forward to seeing a little video of one.
Yeah, I can show you that. Definitely show you that.
Yeah, so I'm excited to see that. Emma, thank you so much for today. Welcome. I could just sit here and pick your brains, like, for about 3 hours. Just because you're just so passionate about this, and it's just lovely to have a conversation like this with you. And I know that lots of people listening to this will find this really useful, because it is like the black hole of, we don't know what happens in there.
Absolutely.
So this is just amazing. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. And if this podcast is bringing you any value or helping you in any way, what would be really lovely and what we would really appreciate is if you could hop over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a little review. And if you have liked it, give us 5 stars, because this is the thing that will help other people find our podcast too. And that's how podcasts get seen. So it would cost nothing in terms of money and just a few seconds of your time, but would really mean so much to us. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back next time.